All right, the talk apparently was as clear as it seemed to me, Cliff. I have one announcement to make before we go on to the next speaker. We're not showing favoritism, but it turns out only Catholics have a hard constraint to go to church on Sundays, and therefore they're the only people we're making provisions for explicitly. If you anticipate going to the to Mass tomorrow, there is an 8 o'clock Mass in a church in Webster. I think it's a Catholic church. And I'm not sure how far ecumenism has gone down here. If you would let the receptionist know, you'll be picked up at your motel at an appropriate time to get you to the church on time. Now move into a discussion of the launch through lunar orbit. We've told you that we're going to lay out the whole program, and we intend to be frank with you. This is one of our Franks named Peter, who your official title is Chief of the Mission Analysis Branch and the Flight Operations Director. Pete.
I don't want to shake you up, Owen, but you're going to have to throw out all that launch window data you showed a while ago. We redesigned the nominal mission over the lunch hour here to incorporate a direct transmitter injection.
You can really hurt a guy.
The purpose of this session is to show how the various constraints affect our lunar mission planning. We're primarily concerned with the effects of these constraints on the trajectory shaping and also the determination of launch opportunities. Now, trajectory geometric constraints plus spacecraft performance capability or limitations actually limit the accessible areas on the lunar surface to which we can conduct lunar landings. Now, this limitation to accessible areas combines then with our operational constraints to limit our launch opportunities to very specifically defined periods. Now, to really understand these mission planning considerations and to appreciate the effects of these constraints, we must examine the trajectory characteristics. And I intend this afternoon to explain the interrelation of some of these constraints on trajectory shaping. Now, unfortunately, it gets somewhat detailed, especially for certain phases of the mission. But I really feel that it's necessary if we really want to appreciate the problem. I'm going to begin with launch and work through the mission phase by phase, at least up through lunar orbit insertion. Also, I don't have time to discuss every trajectory shaping consideration. We'll only hit the highlights, really, and discuss those that have a major effect on our mission planning. Now, in the launch phase, we're only concerned this afternoon with launch windows. All the trajectory shaping aspects of the boost flight to optimize performance and minimize heating and that sort of thing are not our concern here. Of course, that is a big problem to the people designing the launch vehicle, but as far as an overall mission planning consideration, we're just not concerned with that this afternoon. By a launch window, I mean a finite time when the launch can occur, and there's two types of launch windows we're concerned with. These are daily and monthly launch windows. A daily launch window consists of a few hours in any given 24-hour period, and it's continuous from opening to closing. And a monthly launch window then consists of a series of these daily launch windows, and it may or may not be continuous. That is, it could span some 5 to 7 days, for example, but we might not find a daily launch window for every day during that period. The necessity for launch windows is fairly obvious, and I think I'll just skip over talking on that at this time. I would like to say that we feel that there's a minimum daily window to which we want to plan missions, and that's on the order of 2 to 2.5 hours. And this is based on some historical data for other space programs. It indicates that if a launch is held or interrupted, the countdown is interrupted for more than this period of time, you're probably not going to launch anyway. There's something serious enough that's going to cause the mission to be scrubbed. So we're not really going to constrain our planning to provide a launch window any greater than 2 to 2.5 hours. Now, how do we obtain the daily launch window? As indicated here, this is provided by having a variable launch azimuth capability. Now, I will explain that mechanism there when we get to the transmitter injection phase, but for now, just let's assume that you have to have this variable launch azimuth capability if you want to provide a daily window. Now, the limitations to the variable azimuth, as we see, are range safety, booster performance, and something called insertion tracking. By range safety, we are constrained to certain launch azimuths so that if we have to abort during this phase, all the pieces will fall on the range. We won't have anything fall on people off the range. Now, the limitations that we're working to then are a 72-degree minimum launch azimuth and 108-degree maximum. And this is defined by our range safety constraints. Now, there is some indication that this could be relaxed. These numbers have been with us for a long time, but we're not really too interested in relaxing this for two reasons. First, a launch azimuth range of 72 to 108 gives us almost a 4.5 hour window, and so we don't really need to get it any bigger because it's well in excess of our 2.5 hour requirement. And the second reason is if you extend launch azimuths away from 90 degrees, you start paying a booster payload performance penalty. And since we don't need this extra launch window, we're just not interested in extending this range safety limit. And this gives some indication of what sort of a payload penalties would have to be paid to provide this additional launch azimuth capability. This just shows a decrease in payload as a function of launch azimuth, and you can see that our payload is maximized around 90 degrees. And because of this sharp slope here in the curve as we approach the 70 and 110 degree launch azimuths, we just aren't interested in going beyond these azimuths. There is a requirement for insertion tracking. This is necessary to provide a go, no-go decision after insertion into orbit, and we feel like we need about 3.5 minutes of tracking following this insertion. Now, since the insertion occurs some 1,500 nautical miles downrange, we have to put a ship down there to get the tracking. We don't have a ground station that can cover that, and it's the tracking coverage capability of this ship that finally limits us to a range of usable launch azimuths. Now, this slide illustrates the problem. It's not drawn to scale. I don't have all the ground networks on here, but I'm just trying to show how this requirement for insertion tracking coverage provides us with a launch azimuth range limit. You see the ground tracks there for the 72-degree launch azimuth and the 108. The two dotted lines, again, are just representative of the locus here. This is the orbit insertion position across this launch azimuth, and this represents the position the vehicle would be some 3.5 minutes after insertion. Now, the circle is the tracking coverage provided by one ship. And to determine the range of usable launch azimuths, we locate the ship such that we can just barely cover this 3.5 minute position and find what launch azimuth then corresponds to this position right here, where we just cover the insertion position. And that turns out to be about a 26-degree spread in launch azimuth. So that we can summarize the constraints on the daily launch window in terms of their launch azimuth limits is we must launch between the values of 72 to 108 degrees, but within those outer limits, then, we can only use a 26-degree range. Now, getting to the monthly launch window, as it's indicated here, we obtain this monthly launch window by providing multiple launch opportunities. Now, that's really the subject of this whole session, and it's going to take me about an hour or so to show how that's done. So I'm going to skip over that. We'll come back to it when we get through with this. Now, the limitations, actually the limitations are to this providing multiple launch opportunities is what's going to take so long. The only thing I want to mention right now is the effect of the vehicle recycle time in determining what's really required in terms of a minimum launch window. Now, this is a plot of some data that was actually generated by Bellcom for the NASA headquarters, and I lifted a figure from some of their reports. And it's simply a plot of hold and recycle capability as a function of time to go in the countdown. The dotted line shows the hold capability, and we can see that prior to T-minus 15 hours, we have an indefinite period that we can just hold indefinitely, and this is reduced considerably. However, the important curve here is the recycle time as indicated by the solid curve. Notice that it is increasing as we proceed in the countdown, and it takes a fairly large jump there at T-minus 8 hours. That corresponds to when the cryogenics are loaded on board the vehicle. The one point I really want to make with this, though, is that if we were to scrub this mission just prior to launch, that it would take some 40 hours before we could recycle the vehicle and get it ready again for another launch. So that if we want to provide a recycle capability with our launch window, it must be at least 3 days in duration. And I say at least 3 days because this does not include any time required to repair systems or replace components or anything of that nature. That's simply the nominal time to turn the vehicle around and get it ready again for a subsequent launch. And I believe it was indicated earlier this morning how the probability of our launch increases considerably as we have additional monthly launch window capability beyond this 3 days. There's just one other point I'd like to make before leaving this launch phase, and that has to do with the daylight launch. We're planning for a daylight launch capability. We did not intend to make this, it's not a hard constraint in that we refuse to conduct a mission with night launches. However, we're doing everything we can to provide the daylight launch. Now, the reasons we desire a daylight launch are shown here. If we had to abort off the pad or early in the boost phase, the recovery of the crew from this Merritt Island area would be highly complicated by darkness conditions. So we want to avoid that. We also, later on in the launch phase, when aborts require spacecraft attitude maneuvering to successfully accomplish the abort, we'd like to provide a sunlit horizon as a backup attitude reference for the crew. And finally, we'd like to have photographic coverage of the initial first stage flight so that this could be used as post-flight data in case there was some catastrophic failure in this phase. So we want daylight launches, and we're working to provide them. However, we're not going to constrain the mission such that we would not launch in darkness if it was necessary. Let's move on then to the Earth parking orbit phase. Now, why do we want to use Earth parking orbits? And the main reason is to provide launch windows or launch opportunities. If we were constrained to only the direct injection, we'll find that the times during the year or during a given month when we could launch are just unreasonably short. So we feel like to provide any sort of flexibility at all in getting this mission launched, we have to use the Earth parking orbit mode. Now, this does not say that on those rare occasions when a direct injection is possible, we would not use it. There's no constraint into the systems that I know of that would prevent us from going on a direct injection when that was available. All right. Now, in this Earth parking orbit phase, I'm only concerned with two things, and that's the duration of the parking orbit. That's maximum and minimum duration. We have a maximum limit that's due to systems on the launch vehicle which require us to start this second S4B burn within 4.5 hours after inserting into orbit. Now, this is primarily the electrical power supply in the launch vehicle. And also it imposes additional attitude propulsion requirements. There's a couple other reasons we'd like to get off as soon as we could, and that's just due to this propellant boil-off in the S-4B. The longer we stay in orbit, the more propellant we lose. And finally, the platform drift, of course, to minimize that, we want to get out of Earth orbit as soon as possible. So we'd like to hold the period that we're in the Earth parking orbit to as short a time as possible. And then this puts us now to looking at the minimum time at which we can stay in this orbit. Now, this right now is based on the crew activity timeline, and it's currently being carried as an hour and a half minimum time in this Earth parking orbit. But as I say, that's based on a certain set of crew tasks and checklists that they have to perform. Now, there's every indication that these things are going to be reduced considerably, so that the minimum time in the Earth parking orbit will probably come down quite a bit from this hour and a half that we're currently carrying. This just shows where the second injection burn could occur, I mean, on which orbits it could occur if we were to maintain this hour and a half to 4.5 hour constraints on the parking orbit. This is just the ground track for a typical launch, and the dotted line shows that phase of the mission that's now allocated to crew checklists preparing for this second S-4B burn. And the solid lines indicates that part of the orbit in which the injection can occur. I'd like to proceed on then with to the translunar injection phase itself. Now, in this phase, we're going to demonstrate how the injection position requirements actually determine our launch window. The energy requirements to reach the moon are such that we have to burn this S-4B in as efficient manner as we can. And these two combine with the geometry of the moon's orbit to very tightly constrain the positions at which we can perform this translunar injection. First, let's look at the translunar trajectory geometry. Now, in this slide, we're looking down on the moon's orbit plane, and we have the moon out here at successive positions in its orbit. And as indicated here, the translunar trajectory is basically elliptical. And so the problem that we're trying to solve and get to the moon is simply an orbit transfer from a circular Earth orbit to a very highly elliptic orbit. Now, if the moon's gravity did not perturb this trajectory at all, then we would perform it at, we'd have the perigee of this elliptical trajectory coincident with this Earth-Moon line as shown here. And this would give us the most efficient way to get to the lunar altitudes. We'd have an apogee that's just compatible with the lunar distance. Now, obviously, the lunar gravity is going to perturb the trajectory. And to compensate for that, we have to shift the line of apsides of this ellipse around approximately 8 degrees from this Earth-Moon line. Now, the amount of shifting here that has to be done really depends on the energy of this trajectory. But for the free return missions that we plan to fly, this amounts to about 8 degrees. I'd like to define a position vector called the moon's antipode here briefly. This is shown as a vector from the center of the Earth in a direction opposite to the moon position vector. So the antipode is a position vector to this point right here, and it's drawn to the surface of the Earth, and it's in the negative direction of the instantaneous position of the moon. Now, if we want to put ourselves on an elliptic trajectory that's going to rendezvous with the moon out here, we find that the perigee of this ellipse must be about 8 degrees away from this antipode. Now, that position drawn, of course, at the time in which we arrive at the moon, not its current position. So that if we were to perform this maneuver instantaneously, we would try to get the vehicle in this position, some 8 degrees from the antipode, and perform the injection. And that would be the most efficient way to obtain our transmitter trajectory. Now, obviously, we're not going to get an instantaneous injection. As a matter of fact, it's some 5 minutes of thrusting required to get up to the right speed. And just based on some empirical studies of this particular maneuver, it turns out that we actually begin the injection some 5 degrees behind this antipode position. And this results in a burnout, as shown here, some 20 degrees away. But this does locate perigee within 8 degrees of the antipode. And so that if we want to go to the moon efficiently, we've got to put ourselves in this sort of a position relative to the antipode. Now, this only shows the planar case where the trajectory is in the Earth-Moon plane. If we're out of the Earth-Moon plane, as is the general rule, we'll find that this trajectory is actually just pivoted about this Earth-Moon line, so that we still have this requirement of getting that vehicle in the vicinity of the antipode so we can perform this efficient transmitter injection. Well, if we've got to get to the antipode, we're sitting on the launch pad. Let's see how we get there. The antipode travel relative to the launch pad can really be divided into two motions. There's a long period cycle, which is due to the moon's orbit about the Earth, and then there's a short period cycle, which is just due to the Earth's rotation. And it's convenient to divide this these two motions and look at them separately before we combine them. Now this illustrates the long period motion of the antipode. Here we fixed the Earth. We're not letting it rotate, and the moon then is orbiting around the Earth. Now, the moon's orbit plane cuts the Earth as shown here, and the antipode then will trace a path in this plane around the surface of the Earth. Now, if the moon is here, the antipode is located here. And because the moon's period is about 28 days, we find that the antipode is traveling around the Earth at about a half degree per hour, a little over a half degree per hour. And notice that it's traveling in a direction from west to east. This sketch just illustrates the one full cycle of this antipode's travel in latitude. And this other slide then shows the short period motion of the antipode. And in this case, we fixed the moon in its orbit, and we're holding it still and letting the Earth rotate. And from this, we can see that the antipode now is going to travel from east to west and relative to the surface of the Earth, and it's moving at Earth's rotation rate about 15 degrees per hour. So then we'll combine both of these motions then consider both these motions in order to affect our rendezvous. And this is shown in this slide. Now here, let's assume this sphere is an inertial sphere, and it's a surface on which, in this case, the launch pad is rotating. The launch pad would travel a path as shown by this dotted line, and the antipode now will travel a path as shown by this dotted line. The launch pad, traveling at 15 degrees per hour, of course, completes the cycle once every roughly 24 hours. The antipode, traveling at about 0.5 degrees per hour, completes its cycle once every month. Now, the solid lines indicate the ground tracks or the traces of trajectories that are launched from this pad on the different azimuths. Now, this upper one is for a 72-degree launch azimuth, and this case is for a 108-degree launch azimuth. Now, we can see that the problem then is to time this launch so that this pad is in the launch pad's in the right position, so that on this azimuth we will intercept the antipode, which is moving in this plane here. And obviously, with the two different launch azimuths, we must launch with the pad in two different positions, or in other words, with the pad at two different launch times. I don't have any extra parking orbits shown on here, but all that does is bias the launch time slightly. You just compensate for the time period that you're in orbit. to allow the antipode to travel to the right position. Now there are two times when we can launch for any one of these launch azimuths, and that's probably better shown in this next line. Now this shows a problem in Earth fixed coordinates now, and this is just a Mercator projection of the Earth. Now this sketch up here illustrates the situation that we're looking at, where the Moon is at about a 10 degree north declination, and then the antipode would be down here in the 10 degree south latitudes. Now, this invisible dotted line here is the trace of the antipode through the day. Now, remembering the antipode is moving in an inertial orbit, and of course these coordinate systems here are rotating, so that in one day the antipode is going to trace a path all the way across this longitude band. Now then, the ground tracks shown here for these two launch azimuths indicate that if we want a rendezvous with this moving antipode, we must launch on a 72-degree azimuth when the antipode is in a position about here. Of course, allowing for the flight time from launch to this interception. But we could also launch on a 72-degree azimuth after the antipode has traveled all the way over to this position, so that you can see that one azimuth has two launch times associated with it, one when the antipode is in a region here and the other when the antipode is in this region here. Now, of course, the same is true for any azimuth. It's shown here for the 108 degrees, the same situation. The time period that it takes the antipode to travel from this position to this position is a measure of the launch window duration. That is, we could launch any time the antipode is in this region simply by selecting the proper launch azimuth, and we know it'll be somewhere between 72 and 108 degrees. So that the duration, the time period that the antipode takes to travel from here to here, as I say, defines the duration of our launch window. And of course, it would define it for any subset of the 26-degree azimuth range that we talked about earlier. Now also, of course, we have another window over here associated with the antipode travel from this position to this position. Now, these two windows are distinguished by the names Atlantic window appropriate for this one and the Pacific window for this one over in this region. There's a point I'd like to make about the inclination relative to the Moon's orbit plane. Now, this line indicated here, this sort of dotted dash line there and there and here and through here, represent the cut that the Moon orbit plane would make at the instant that the antipode was in this position. And this is actually the inertial plane that the antipode is traveling in. It's moving in this direction. The case we have shown here, the Moon is ascending in its orbit. That is, it's moving toward its maximum northern declination, and the antipode is descending or traveling south. Now, in this case, we can see that the trajectories that follow a Pacific injection have a very high inclination relative to this Moon orbit plane. And the trajectories that follow an Atlantic injection are very close to being in the Moon orbit plane. 14 days later, when the situation is reversed and the Moon antipode would be traveling in this direction, we would find that the Pacific trajectories are very close to being in plane, and the Atlantic then had very high inclinations to the Moon orbit plane. But regardless of where the Moon's position in its orbit, whether it's ascending or descending, a Pacific injected trajectory will always be above the Moon orbit plane, and an Atlantic injected trajectory will always be below the Moon orbit plane. Now that has some rather far-reaching effects, which we'll show later. But want to keep that point in mind, that when we go out of the Atlantic injection window, the trajectory will always be below this Moon orbit plane, and the opposite is true then for the Pacific injection window. Now, we intend to provide at least two injection opportunities for this mission, and what I mean by that is, if let's say this represents the nominal orbit on which we would inject or perform the second burn, second S4B burn. If we found, as we approached this thrust initiation position, that for some reason we were not ready to perform the maneuver, we wouldn't have to give up the mission. We could go right on by, go through another orbit, and we would find that we had returned again to the vicinity of the antipode, since both of these planes are inertial, and of course relative to the Earth they'll both shift over into this region, but we will return again to this vicinity of this antipode. Now, because in general the trajectory plane and the moon's orbit plane are not coincident, we find that this would cause us to have to perform a plane change at the second injection opportunity. And this next slide will show a detail of this condition. This is just a more detailed sketch of the vicinity in the region of the antipode. And here is the we're looking down on the Earth now, and this is the moon's orbit plane. This is the plane of the parking orbit. And we've shown a case where the inclination between these two planes is approximately 60 degrees, and that's about the maximum that we ever encounter during any month. Now, in the case we have shown here, the launch was timed perfectly for a first injection opportunity, such that we approached the position at which we wanted to reignite the S4B, and we find the antipode is in plane, right where we wanted it. Now, then, if we couldn't make this burn, we go around an extra orbit, we find the antipode over here, out of plane, and we must have the outbound trajectory plane contain the antipode, so we'll have to make a plane change in order to accomplish that. Well, we do intend to guarantee two injection opportunities, so that this additional azimuth change means that it's going to affect our payload capability, and that we must load or offload payload or increase the propellant requirements to provide us with this extra azimuth change capability. Now, we can minimize this effect by actually finding a launch time such that we split the delta azimuth or the plane change between the two opportunities. That is, as we approach the moon's orbit plane here for our first injection opportunity, we would find the antipode slightly out of plane in a position over here. And that if we missed that opportunity and went around again in the second orbit, when we came back, we'd find that the antipode then had traveled through the plane and was in a position over here. However, this does minimize the total delta azimuth that we have to budget for. This slide just gives an example of the kind of savings that this launch timing technique provides. I don't think I'll go into any more detail on this, except to show that if we had timed the launch as shown in this sketch, we'd find that this is a velocity penalty for additional injection opportunities, and this represents the additional injection opportunity, the initial one and the second and the third injection over here. But if we had timed the launch so that the first one was in plane, we'd see that there's a fairly large additional velocity penalty required to provide us a second injection. This case shows the additional velocity penalty associated with splitting this launch azimuth between the two opportunities, and we find that this represents a net saving that we can realize by this kind of a launch timing procedure. Okay, all of these constraints that I've described now in this transmitter injection phase can be combined and result then in an envelope of possible injection positions. And that's represented on this slide. The longitude regions, or the longitude boundary of this envelope, the western side of this is determined by the maximum number of of Earth orbits, and the maximum launch azimuth. Now, in this case, this boundary is determined by the 108-degree launch azimuth and injection on the third parking orbit. The eastern boundary is defined by the minimum number of orbits and the minimum launch azimuth, or 72-degree azimuth combined with a two-orbit minimum would yield a boundary like this. If we were able to go on the first orbit The 72-degree azimuth would result in an increase in this injection area out to this value here. Now, the latitude limits are simply defined by the maximum declinations of the moon. And you can clearly see our two injection areas that we're speaking of. The Atlantic injection window is this one, and the Pacific injection window is this one. And, of course, it continues on over to here. Let's move on then now to the translunar coast phase. In this phase, I'm going to talk about this inclination of this trajectory relative to the moon plane, moon orbit plane. I'm going to mention free returns and the constraints that this imposes on the flight planning, and describe the lunar orbit insertion geometry. And these first three are closely linked, and we'll actually be discussing them. We'll be intermingling the discussion of these first three items. And finally, I'm going to come back and briefly mention some alternative flight plans that we might, that we would find attractive to this free return constraint. This slide is just using as a link to get out to the moon. It shows the trajectory relative to the moon orbit plane, as represented by this line. Now, the trajectory from a Pacific injection is going to be always be above this plane, as we stated. And the trajectories following Atlantic injections we'll find always below the moon orbit plane. Now, they may be very close to being in plane, or they may be very highly inclined, but for Atlantic windows, we'll always be below the plane. Now, the significance of this is can be shown in this slide, which indicates the a more detailed picture of the conditions in the vicinity of the moon. This represents the moon, and Earth is off in this direction. And this is the moon's orbit plane. Now, as we approach the moon from above the plane, we find that we have a much easier time landing at sites that are located north of this moon orbit plane. That is, if we have landing sites in this region on the front side of the moon above this moon orbit plane, our performance requirements to get to those sites are greatly reduced if we can use this Pacific injection window, because these things are much more closely to being in the plane at which we approach the moon. And the converse would be true then for the southern latitude landing sites. The relative inclinations here are highly exaggerated. We really don't have that much of a spread between these two. I'm just trying to dramatize the situation by exaggerating. Actually, the free return confines us to very, very low inclinations. But the point is still very valid, and we'll see how valid it is in a few minutes when we get to looking at the accessible area and the constraints that that has on launch windows. Now I'd like to consider this free return flight plan, and I think if there's one thing that's causing us the greatest performance constraints on this mission, it would be this free return flight plan. First, let me define or restate again what I mean by free return. That a free return trajectory is one which, following the launch vehicle injection cutoff here, would circumnavigate the moon and return to Earth, entering the safe atmosphere entry corridor without any subsequent maneuvers required, so that if we have a complete propulsion system failure, the crew and the spacecraft would be recovered with this kind of a flight plan. Now, the reentry corridor here is about 26 miles in terms of return perigee altitude, plus or minus 13 about the corridor's midpoint. To provide injection, the injection cutoff accuracy that's necessary to provide this kind of a dispersion and return trajectory perigee, that is, following this whole trajectory and return to a perigee altitude that's within 12 to 13 miles of a nominal value, is something like a tenth of a foot per second. Obviously, that's well beyond the capability of any inertial guidance system. especially when you realize we're putting in something like 10,000 feet per second in that particular maneuver. However, it's still valid to target or to plan the mission around this free return, because this method or this procedure at least minimizes the mid-course correction requirements to return to Earth. That is, we know we're not going to get a free return trajectory, but we're going to get close enough to one that we can correct it back to free return conditions simply by using the RCS system on the service module. That is, we can use the translation delta V out of that attitude control system and put in enough mid-course corrections to compensate for the injection errors here, so that indeed if we did have a main propulsion system failure, we can return the spacecraft safely to Earth. Now, just how does this free return flight plan penalize our performance? And there are two major effects. These are the narrow range of flight times that we can use, flight times to the moon, and still obtain free return conditions, and also the very narrow range of approach inclinations that we can have and still maintain free return conditions. Now, by being constrained to to provide free returns, the flight times to the moon must be between 60 and 80 hours in the actual time, depending on the lunar distance or how far out it is in its orbit and whether it's ascending or descending. There's a lot of things, but the range is always between 60 and 80 hours. Now, if we were not constrained to free return, we could go to the moon at flight times on the order of 110 hours, much lower energy trajectories. So that one aspect of this flight time constraint is that we're approaching the moon at higher energies than is absolutely necessary. Now, with a higher approach energy, obviously means we must put in more delta V to slow the vehicle down and break it into lunar orbit. Now, that's one penalty due to this flight time. The other is on the location of the perilune position. Now, this indicates the relationship to flight time on the actual location of perilune. We've shown three cases here. This is a short transfer time or a very high energy trajectory. This represents the moon, and it's would be traveling in this direction in its orbit around the Earth. So that this perilune of these very high energy trajectories is located way around here on the leading edge of the moon. And then for the longer transit times, those 110 hours or so, we find that the perilune is now located on the trailing edge of the moon. But for the free return flight times, this 60 to 80 hour band, we find that the perilune is always located in a region approximately 10 degrees of this 180 degree selenographic longitude. That is, if you take the Earth-Moon line and just run it to the far side of the moon, we'll find that perilune for the free return trajectories is within 10 degrees of that vector. Now, and this is one of the primary factors that causes our delta V budget to be fairly high, and we'll see that in just a minute. In addition to this flight time constraint, the inclinations with which we can approach the moon are also very tightly constrained by free return. This is represented in this sketch. Again, this is the far side of the moon now, and this just illustrates the range of approach inclinations that will provide us with these free return conditions. Now, the maximum value of this range is on the order of 10 degrees. But on any one particular day, it's usually less than 3 and 4 degrees, so that we choose a day for the mission and we're going to go free return, we only have about a 3 or 4 degree range of approach inclinations that we can use. Now, this then, combined with the longitude limitations, means that all the perilunes of our approach trajectories will be confined to a little cone, as shown here. So that it's like a funnel or a bottleneck, that all of these trajectories are going to come into that position and have the perilune located in that region. Now, and this is really the basis of the performance penalty, is of the free return. Now, the lunar orbit insertion is performed at or near perilune, And this is to take advantage of some of the in-plane geometry, which you'll describe in just a minute. But in general, we have to make a plane change at this maneuver in order to pass over the landing site. Now, in the effectiveness of this plane change in allowing us, or the effectiveness of the delta azimuth changes in allowing us to pass over the landing site is strongly depends on where this landing site is located relative to this parallel position. Now, in this sketch, I'll try to point out the problem. Here, I've just removed the moon from the picture, but assume that this inner plane is the lunar equator. This is a landing site now located on the front side of the moon, and a perilune then of our approach hyperbola is located back in here. Now, let's assume that we're approaching the moon in this plane shown here, so that we now want to perform the lunar orbit insertion maneuver, and we must pass over this landing site. Well, obviously, we've got a tremendous plane change to make here to come through that position, get back over the site. And this is really the geometric constraint that we're faced with these narrow limits on the parallel position. Now, it's not near as bad a problem, of course, if the landing site are located away from this node. When the landing site is over in this region, the plane changes are not nearly so drastic. So that to get to this site, we'd like very much to move this lunar orbit insertion maneuver away from this point. But as we say, in general, we desire to perform this maneuver at perilune. And this next slide will show what could be done if we backed up on the trajectory to perform this lunar orbit insertion. Now we're looking at the far side of the moon again, and this is our approach hyperbola, the lunar landing site here. This represents the perilune position of this approach trajectory. Now then, if we perform the insertion maneuver here, you can see we have a much greater plane change to make than if we backed up in the orbit on the approach trajectory and performed the maneuver here. Now, so that we can save quite a bit in a delta V at this maneuver by reducing the plane change. Now, we don't get it free because we're paying for it by making flight path angle changes as shown in this figure over here. This is an in-plane, the geometry of the in-plane situation. The dotted lines represent the lunar orbit that we want to break into. And the far right case over here shows the situation when we're performing the lunar orbit insertion maneuver at perilune. Now, all that's required of this maneuver is to simply slow the vehicle down. We're already at the right, the velocity is going in the right direction. All we got to do is get at the right magnitude. However, if we want to perform the maneuver at some place other than perilune, the first thing we got to do is reduce the perilune altitude. And that's so that we can get the altitude of this maneuver back down to the desired lunar orbit altitude. Now, when we do that, you can see that not only do we have to slow the vehicle down, but we must also bend the velocity vector over to conform to the direction of our desired orbit. Now, bending the velocity vector in plane is just as expensive as bending it over here in the horizontal plane. So it's a trade-off that's performed in the mission design. And this perilune altitude is one of the primary factors in determining the optimum trajectory geometry for this translunar or this particular phase of the mission. We actually determine the perilune altitude that provides us the best combination of flight path angle change and delta azimuth change. And by the best, I mean it's the minimum delta V required here. However, in no case do we use a perilune altitude that's below 40 nautical miles. Our orbit altitude here is some 80 miles. Okay, now this particular process gives us quite a bit of relief from the constraints are imposed by the free return trajectory. However, there's nothing spectacular gained here. We improve the situation, but we don't suddenly get the whole front face of the moon opened up to us as a potential landing area. As a result of this, we have looked at alternatives to this free return, some method that we could maintain some of the safety advantages of it and yet not be forced to live with the performance penalties. Now, there are several alternatives to the free return that you can imagine, and this next slide shows one of them. Most of them are just variations of this type of a flight plan. In this trajectory, as we've shown here, the launch vehicle again inserts a spacecraft on a free return trajectory. Now, it could be an ellipse, which does not go around the moon, it does return safely, re-enters the entry corridor, or it could be a circumlunar free return also. It's the results are still valid. Now then, after remaining on this trajectory some 5 or 6 hours, the spacecraft, using its service propulsion system, would then perform a mid-course maneuver, which then places it on the circumlunar trajectory. The features of this flight plan are that initially we are on a free return, and we remain on a free return until two things have happened. First, we've docked and separated from the launch vehicle. We have a LEM descent engine to act as a propulsion backup. And the second thing is that we have checked out the service propulsion system before we perform this maneuver. So we remain free return until we have a propulsion backup and we've checked out our primary system. Now then, the third feature is that by not constraining this to the free return characteristics, we can now approach the moon on just about any inclination we want, and we can locate perilune by varying the flight time over a wide range of longitudes. Now, the increase in accessible area that we can get from this kind of a flight plan is shown on this slide. Now, this is a plot of the selenographic latitude as a function of longitude. This 0-0 point is the nominal pierce point of the Earth-Moon line. We're looking at the front face of the moon here. This inner area that's defined by these two lines that are very close to the selenographic equator represents the area that is obtainable with a free return flight plan for a typical month. That is, we can get to any area, to any position in this area throughout a given month. Now, the outer lines show the increase in accessible area that can be realized by freeing up these approach conditions from the free return characteristics. So you can see that we do have something that you might call a spectacular increase in the accessible area, and yet we have maintained basically the free return capability at least until we've got our backup propulsion system and have checked out the main engine. The service propulsion system. One of the problems with these hybrid flight plans is that there are additional maneuvers involved, and this does complicate our mission optimization or the planning procedures. And frankly, we're not in as good a position to rapidly design these kind of flight plans as we are the free return. However, we're working on this capability and making every effort to develop it as soon as we can. But we just can't turn out this kind of a flight plan as rapidly as we can the free returns at this time. Well, let's proceed on then with the lunar orbit phase. There's only two things that I want to discuss in this phase, and that is the duration of the parking orbits, the number of parking orbits, and the inclination of these. Again, we find the duration is governed by the crew timelines or the activities that are planned for the crew to perform. Between lunar orbit insertion and the actual descent trajectory, we're planning 3 parking orbits. And between rendezvous after the LEM landing and the trans-Earth injection, we're planning 2 parking orbits. Now, of course, while the crew is performing their checklists and getting systems ready, the ground networks are tracking the vehicle as it crosses the front face of the moon, and they are performing their orbit determination problems. And in these particular phases, even if we do find some way to reduce the crew activities, I doubt that the number of parking orbits would be reduced, because we need that data for the ground network. The inclination of the lunar orbit is another one of the primary factors that's used to optimize the trajectory, the overall trajectory. Now, of course, the moon not only is orbiting, but is rotating, and we find that the landing site is going to rotate in and out of the plane of our parking orbit. Now, this dashed line represents the inertial parking orbit plane, and we are targeting the lunar orbit insertion maneuver so that the resulting plane, the resulting orbital plane, will contain the landing site at the time we're ready to land. That is, we've built in the bias to allow for this time between insertion and landing, so that when we actually insert into orbit, we'll find that the lunar landing site would be located at a position over here. When we perform the landing, then, it will be in plane. And when we get ready to launch, of course, the landing site's continued to rotate out of plane, and we'll find that the landing site would be located over here. Now, we plan a command module or a command and service module orbital maneuver prior to the LEM launch to bring the parking orbit plane back over this landing site so that the LEM maneuvers, both landing and ascent, nominally, will be in plane. And then this third maneuver, this trans-Earth injection, also generally involves a plane change, so that our optimization procedure, our minimizing propellant-required procedure, is to take this lunar orbit and wiggle it or find the proper orientation that minimizes the total delta-V requirements for all three of those maneuvers. That's the lunar orbit insertion and the plane change and the trans-Earth injection. Okay, well, I've covered now all of the trajectory shaping parameters that I want to discuss, and I'm ready to go back and examine launch opportunities. The constraints on launch opportunities are shown here, the ones that I'm going to look at. And these are launch azimuth, lighting conditions at lunar landing, the landing site location, spacecraft performance, and also want to look at what a daylight launch constraint would do. And finally, the minimum number of launch opportunities per month, or actually the launch window configuration, what effects that would have on determining our launch opportunities. Just a few minutes ago, I showed how that the specification of launch azimuth limits actually defined when the launch would occur. That determined the launch window in any given day. And we also said that there were two windows every day. Now, this figure just summarizes the launch opportunities available if our only constraint were launch azimuth. And it's a plot of time of launch from midnight on any given day throughout the year. Now, a day, of course, would just be one vertical line up this scale. The white areas represent the launch opportunities, or the launch windows, and the P stands for Pacific injection and the A for Atlantic injection. The only point I want to make with this line is that we do have 2 4.5-hour windows every day if all we had to worry about was the launch azimuth. Now, one, I believe there was a question earlier this morning about whether this February the 5th launch was a night launch, and this apparently is the case. Let's look in here about February, and we were using the Pacific window, and we can see that for the 1st of February, we're in the middle of the afternoon when the window closes off, but as we move into the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and so on of February, we're getting later and later in the afternoon when the launch must occur. And finally, somewhere about in here, which looks, must be the 5th, we get a night launch requirement. Okay, the next two constraints I'd like to discuss concurrently, and that is the lighting conditions at lunar landing and the landing site location. These two are really inseparable, and we'll have to discuss them together. In order to provide the LEM crew with the best possible visibility conditions during the landing, we're constraining the mission to have the sun elevation angle at the time of landing between 7 and 20 degrees above the eastern horizon. This allows the crew to evaluate the landing area that they're approaching and possibly to select the best region in this area in which to land. Now, the range of this sun elevation angles has a major effect on our launch windows, and as we say, it's about 13 degrees. The lighting problem is shown in this sketch. This is about the zero point, zero longitude, zero latitude position on the moon, and this is the sunrise terminator. That is, the shadow is moving in this direction. Now, the area enclosed by this dotted line represents the sum total of all the lunar surface on which we could land on this particular day with this 7 to 20 degree lighting constraint. Now, this band of area moves across the face of the moon following this sunrise terminator at about 13 degrees per day. So just by looking at lunar ephemeris data, we can determine very easily which longitudes or which regions of the moon are available for landing on a given day. In the region near this equator, we find that a 1 degree of longitude is approximately equivalent to a 1 degree change in elevation angle, and that's generally inherent in all these assumptions that we are making. Now then, if we go to this lunar ephemeris data and determine when the lighting is acceptable for landing, we come up with a figure that looks something like this. This shows the days when the lighting is acceptable for longitudes between 45 degrees east and 45 degrees west. Now, I've shown it for two typical months here. That is, if you're interested in a particular longitude, you can come across here and read that longitude, and this, when you get to this band of lighting between 7 and 20 degrees, you can read down and find what day that landing site is available for landing, or that site is available for landing. Notice that the acceptable lighting does shift from east to west across the front face of the moon. And also notice that there's only about a 9-day period total here from this point to this point. That is, we immediately must throw away 19 to 20 days out of every month in which a landing mission is possible without even looking at specific sites or any of those problems. We're looking only at the region, at the whole region between 45 east and 45 west. Now, because our mission time has relatively small variations in the time from launch to Earth launch to lunar landing, we can put on a plot similar to this the resulting landing dates or arrival times associated with different launch dates, and that's shown on this next slide. This is the same type of plot. Again, we have longitude and function of calendar date. This line represents the 7-degree sun elevation condition, and this would be the 20-degree sun elevation condition. Now, these dates shown along here represent different launch dates. And the way we can read this is, let's take this February the 1st date here. This represents the time at which we would land. This is shown to be in the 5th of February. If we were to launch on the 1st of February. Now, there's a lot of simplifying assumptions in here, but they don't really significantly affect this picture. One is, I'm only looking at one window. This is a Pacific injection window. Notice also that I can launch on February the 1st, okay, but it's not an acceptable mission day if I don't have a landing site located in this region of longitudes. Now, of course, without the lighting constraint, I could land at any one of these longitudes. But by being confined to this particular lighting, if I want to use that day as a launch day, I've got to have a landing site located in this longitude region. So it's pretty clear how this landing site location and the lighting limitations combine to constrain our launch opportunities. Now, we can use this kind of a figure to look at what sort of a landing site distribution we require if we want to provide a launch window of a certain configuration. For example, if you wanted to provide consecutive days, a launch window, say, of three consecutive days, and you can see, let's pick February 1st, 2nd, and 3rd as an example, that I must provide one landing site that's in a longitude region here. I must have another one that's in a region here. And finally, I must have another one that's in this region here. So that by just looking at this spread in longitudes, we can see that to provide consecutive day type launch windows, the sites must be located between 8 and 13 degrees apart in longitude. And if they're located in any other longitude spread, you cannot guarantee that you're going to get consecutive launch windows. You might, but you can't guarantee it. Now, if we want to provide an alternate day launch window, for example, this 1-3-5 configuration, we can also look at this same figure, and let's say we want to go on the 1st, the 3rd, and the 5th of February. Well, we go through the same little routine, but it turns out then that the sites, you still only need three sites, but they now must be located about 20 to 26 degrees apart. And your total spread then on the sites has to compensate for this this 5-day duration. So that, again, this lighting and landing site location is a very strong influence on our launch opportunities. Okay, I'd like to go on now and look at the performance aspects on limiting launch windows. And again, we'll consider the combination of performance and landing site location. However, now we're concerned with the latitude location of the landing site rather than its longitude. As I mentioned, the free return does confine us to a very narrow region of accessible areas. And if we're to have a mission, we not only must have the lighting right at the day we want to land, but we must not only have a landing site in the right lighting band, but it also must be accessible. And so we really have to meet these two constraints. We can have good lighting, but if it's located at such a latitude that we can't reach it, well, then we still don't have an available launch day. Now, the accessible area for a particular day, or for any one given day, it looks something like this. Again, this is a plot of latitude versus longitude. And this shows the areas on the moon that we can get on this particular day. Now, this is just a typical situation. Notice Pacific injections provide us with a greater capability at northern latitudes than the Atlantic, and vice versa on the south. And this, of course, is due to that geometry I brought out a while ago. As I say, this is only good for one particular day. The next day, we find that due to the lunar librations, these areas have shifted either north or south, depending on which way the librations went. So that we can only look at this area on this day and determine whether that landing site was available. Now, if we look at the effect of the librations throughout a period when the lighting was good, roughly 8 to 9 days, we can do that by examining the latitude limits in this longitude region when the lighting was good in this longitude region. And that's one on one particular day. Then on the next day, let's say the 2nd of February, I'd move over to here, and since the lighting is good in this region, I'd determine the latitude limits on the 2nd of February in this region. Now, you can just follow that all the way across the moon. And if you can remember the difference between this and that previous figure, the area extends quite a bit further south now than it did on the February the 1st, and that's simply due to these librations. The region over here in the east is just the same, because this is for February the 1st, and this is associated with the area available on February the 8th. Okay, now this kind of a concept can be extended to an entire year to show what's available, what we can guarantee for a particular year. Now, this region shown by this type of crosshatching is the area that we can guarantee to reach throughout the year 1968 with the Pacific injection window. This cross area represents that we can reach from an Atlantic injection window. That is, all year long, when the lighting is right, we can get into this region from an Atlantic window, and all year long, when the lighting is right, we can get in this region from a Pacific window. Now, the area in between, we can get to all year, but we can't guarantee which window we're going to have to use to get there. And as indicated here, in the first half of the year, we could obtain this region with Pacific injections. In the last half of the year, an Atlantic injection would be required. Now, this little bitty area shown in here, this little triangle, is what's left of our 100% accessible area from both windows. That is, we can always get to this region from either injection window for the entire year. Now then, the severity of the constraints that are imposed by lighting limitations and performance really depends on the number of landing sites we have and also on the location of those sites. If we could select sites anywhere we wanted, then we couldn't be concerned at all with performance or lighting. We could just go wherever things look good and land. But we are constrained or confined to specific sites, and so that we do have to be concerned about these problems. But to really determine how serious they are, we ought to examine what these constraints do to us in terms of launch opportunities when we take a typical set of landing sites. Now, the ones I'm going to show are for sites that are being photographed by the Lunar Orbiter mission. Now, I have two sets of sites, one for that's to be photographed by Lunar Orbiter A, and the other is to be photographed by the B mission. Now, there are seven sites in this Lunar Orbiter mission that are candidate Apollo landing sites. And there are 11 sites in the B mission that are candidate Apollo landing sites. Now then, if after we examine the data and it's determined, say it were determined that all seven of those sites were acceptable and we could use them, then our launch opportunities in 1968 are summarized by this slide. Now, this again is just the Orbiter A sites. There's seven of them. This is a plot again of the time of launch from midnight to midnight through the calendar for the year 68. Now I have the sunset line shown on here in the sunrise, so that the area in between represents the daylight launch conditions. The solid lines are the launch windows associated with Pacific injections, and the dotted lines are the launch windows associated with Atlantic injections. So that we can take some particular day in here and say that we've got a Pacific window that runs about 4.5 hours right in the middle of the day, and later on that night we find that we could launch and go out to the Atlantic injection window. Now, these little things here are just extensions of the launch windows up here. That's really the same window as the one up there. So that we can see from this figure that we've got about 7 days every month that we can launch, and with seven sites available to us. Pacific injections don't appear. They're become kind of hard to find, and that's because that these seven Orbiter A sites were located just a little too far south as far as the Pacific injection window was concerned. To use Pacific injections, we would need those sites to be located a little bit further north. Now, I can look at these at this data, and without doing anything to it, you can see what a daylight launch constraint would do to you. You still have plenty of launch capability through June and on into the end of August, and even a couple here in September. However, we run out of daylight launch capability toward the end of the year. Now then, if we combine that, however, with a certain launch window configuration, such as the 5 days with 1 day in between, we find that we are constrained a little bit more, and that's shown on this next slide. Now, this is the same Orbiter A sites again, but we're only showing the cases where we have a 1, 3, 5 day launch window. And again, it looks good in the first part of the year. Pacific injections are available, and we can use daylight launches. However, toward the end of June now, we don't quite meet our criteria here. We only have the 3 day window, so this night five day launch window is shown. For the entire last half of the year, we are constrained to night launches. However, with a night launch, we do have our 5 day launch windows for the entire year of 68, and they are provided by these seven sites. There is 1 month here that only has a 3 day window, and that's the end of September. Now then, to try to improve this daylight launch situation, in conjunction with the people from Langley that are conducting this lunar orbiter program, we have determined sites for the B mission that would favor Pacific injections for the Apollo. That is, and actually all we did was shift the region a little bit further north and ask that they be photographed in that area. Now, that was done, and the B sites have been selected for the mission planning so that we can look now at what we would gain in the way of launch opportunities from these Orbiter B sites. And that's shown here. And now we have our daylight launch 12 months out of the year. Even with this 1, 3, 5 day requirement. Well, that concludes the prepared portion of this session. Where are we?
You did very well, Pete. You got us back on schedule. Are there any quick comments before coffee? I think what you're seeing here is the effect of constraints, some of which are real and some of which are in the mind of the organization at the present time. I would point out that some of them will disappear in ensuing years, and just give you one example. We used to talk about the equiperiod orbit as being a very essential thing for the lunar orbit part of the mission because it was so nice to have a natural rendezvous. That fell by the wayside as we began to understand all the implications of it. I think some of these other things, like free return and so on, as we get more comfortable with the hardware and as we begin to learn more about what it really costs us in the mission, may tend to disappear. That's an editorial comment, which need not be rebutted by the rest of the argument. Orin?
It seems to me that two launches out of Earth parking orbit is about to be one of those considered tourist. I guess it has some strengths on performance. And with all the on-time capabilities of the plane, it seems to me that's asking a little too much to maybe compromise it.
All right, it is so logged. I see a hand in the back. Yeah.
Question. Does this assume continuous changing of the launch as one through the window through the period of time?
Not necessarily. It could be either a series of discrete launch azimuths or a continuous launch azimuth. In other words, yes.
Len?
In view of the tight constraint of getting the reentry core and also this mechanization design sitting on this reentry guidance, how do you take account of the effects of the solar cycle and solar activity in the upper atmosphere? It seems to me that you're going into a time frame where we don't have high altitude data. Secondly, if you went into any solar flare situation, you change the scale balance dramatically. Just the time.
I don't think the effects of any solar flares get into it at all. The temporal variations, I guess you'd call them, of the atmosphere are included in the fact that we pick conservative estimates of the atmosphere in defining its corridor. In other words, we try to find a corridor that's compatible with the worst atmosphere we can justify using. Oh, I'm sorry. I mean, they didn't get into our planning on this. As far as I know, there have been no considerations of the effects of solar flares on this atmosphere in planning the mission. I didn't mean they don't physically do.
Yeah. Dennis?
The solar flares from your diagram of the way that the atmosphere is supposed to fly to move around,
no, you mean during the translunar trajectory? No, there has been no constraint on the mission planning due to the radiation.
Could you repeat the question in brief before you go ahead and answer
it? Oh.
Yeah, the question on that last one was because of the way the antipode moves around, you do get a sort of yearly cycle in the part of the radiation belt you go through, and was this a constraint or was this a problem? Is that about right, Dennis? I think my impression is we go through so fast that it is not a problem anyhow. That even though you go through a different part of it, you're traversing relatively quickly, and the net radiation is low by the standards for the mission. Okay, I'd suggest we break for coffee. I think they have a slightly different logistic system than they had before, and I'd like to get you back by 4 o'clock if possible. That won't make it 4:05.